Below, among the celebrants, the philosopher plied his photographic device. On Rogation Sunday, Hans and the other enfeoffed Kränken joined the villagers in the annual progress of the manor. Dietrich led them forth after mass, garbed in a flowing, embroidered green cape and bearing holy water in a brass bucket, on which was engraved the image of a spring bursting from a rock. Behind him, in order of precedence, marched Klaus and Hilde, then Volkmar and his kin, and the other ministeriales for that year, and behind them the mass of villagers, 200 strong, chatting and laughing, with children darting among them as random and as humming as the bees in the meadows. Hans and Gottfried walked beside Dietrich, the latter bearing the aspergum and the former the pail. But Dietrich remembered when the child, Theresia, skipped with that same aspergum clenched in her fist, and Lawrence the smith had carried the pail and held the cape. Had Gottfried taken up Lawrence's old duty as he had taken up Lawrence's name? Now Theresia lingered fearful in the procession's rear. Manfred escorted them astride a white palfrey whose mane had been braided and perfumed and inset with fresh violets. With him were Eugen and Kunigund, and on a small white pony little Ermgard, done up in a lace girdle to mark her chastity, and with unbound hair flowing to her waist. Kunigund, being now wed, enclosed her hair with a wimple. Everard strode with his wife Irmgard and his son Vitold a few paces behind the hare's party. "He's no more noble for traipsing in his lord's muck," Klaus whispered to his wife, loudly enough that Irmgard scowled and gripped her husband's arm. Dietrich had earlier explained to Hans that this was a ceremony only for the familia, which was why Joachim, like the soldiers in the burg, had remained behind. Nevertheless, the Kratzer and a few Kränkisch pilgrims followed with their photographic devices. The ground was yet sodden from the previous week's rains, and soon were hose and shoes spattered and Manfred's horse mud-stained to her hocks. Whenever they came to a boundary marker, Richard Schultheis would point it out, and parents would toss their children in this stream or bump their head against that tree to general laughter and repeated demands to do it again. "A curious custom," Hans said as they progressed. "Yet it touches. One cannot love a world. It is too large, but a fleck of ground, so far as his eye can see. One may hold precious above all." After stopping for a midday meal and a visit by the curious to the Kränkisch vessel, the villagers emerged on the far side of the great woods, where the ground dropped sharply toward the Bear Valley Road. Manfred had reined in on a spur of rock to essay the descent when he suddenly held a palm up. "Quiet!" The chatter of the peasants gave way to louder cries of "Silence there!" and "The hare wants silence!" Finally, there was the sound only of soft breezes and rustling branches from the woods behind them. Everard began to make some remark, but the hare hushed him with a gesture. Faintly, they heard it, the tocsin of a distant bell. It was a single note tolling slowly, borne half-heard like a leaf on the blustery winds. "Angelus already?" someone asked. "Ah, the sun is yet too high. Too deep for St. Catherine's peal, is it St. Peter's?" "St. Wilhelm, I think." "Nah, St. Wilhelm tolls three bells." Then the wind shifted and the faint ringing died. Manfred listened further, but the sound did not repeat itself. "Whose bell was that?" he asked Dietrich. "Mein Herr, I did not recognize it. St. Blasia owns a bass bell called the Paternoster, but this was higher pitched. I think it was more distant than those we usually hear, and some freak of wind brought it to our ears." Manfred scowled toward the Swiss, the direction from which the ringing had seemed to come. "Basel, perhaps?" Hans cried, "Smoke and five riders!" Everard leapt atop a protruding boulder and shaded his eyes. "The monster is right! Altenbach's steading burns. A dust cloud moves off toward the northeast. That five riders are under it," he added as he dropped off the stone. "I will take the word of the bug-eye." Manfred ordered his serfs across the valley to help put out the fire. Hans called the other baptized Krenken to his side. After a deal of pointing and clacking, he and Beatka leapt toward the Altenbach steading, while Gottfried and another hopped into the woods toward the wrecked ship. The fifth stood irresolute.
"How can they leap so far?"
Klaus wondered, for this was the first time he had seen the Krenken in open country.
"Do they wear 7-league boots?"
"No," Dietrich explained. "Beings made of earth move naturally toward the center of the earth. But these beings are drawn less strongly because they come from a different earth. Hans told me that on Krenkholm, his weight or gravitas was greater than here." Klaus grunted, unconvinced, and started after the others. Dietrich seized Theresia by the wrist. "Come, the Altenbachs may need yourselves." But she pulled away from him.
"Kappa, they are here."
Dietrich held his hand out. "Will you lend me, then, your tote?" When Theresia did not move, he whispered,
"And so we see it. First you recoil from these strangers from beyond the firmament, then you recoil from helping your own folk. Did I teach you this from childhood?"
Theresia thrust her bag into his hands.
"Here, take it."
And then she burst into tears.
"Watch over Gregor," she said. "That big fool risks his soul."
As Dietrich hurried after, Gottfried and Winifred Krenk passed overhead in flying harnesses with metal buckets of some sort dangling from them. Glancing back, he noted a small knot of villagers who had stayed behind. Theresia, Volkmar Bauer and his kin, the Ackermans, and one of the Krenken. Well, one did not need 200 men to fight a single fire. Yet, loping by his side were Nickel Langermann and Fulk Albrecht's son, and even Klaus Müller. Nickel grinned.
"Altenbach will owe me favors for this," he said. "It never hurts to have a rich peasant owe you."
Fulk said,
"Hold your flap and hurry, or the fire's out before we get there."
When, breathless, Dietrich had reached the steading, Manfred met him at the gate.
"He needs your sacrament, Pastor," he said, in a voice as sharp as flint.
Dietrich entered the smoldering cottage where the Krenken were putting the flames out with foam they pumped from their curious buckets. On the packed earth floor, Altenbach sat with his hands folded over his midriff, as if after a satisfying meal. Behind him, a woman wept. When he saw Dietrich, Altenbach grimaced.
"Thank God you've come in time," he said. "I'd fain not have her journey alone. Shrive me my sins, but be damn quick about it."
Dietrich saw blood oozing between the fingers.
"That's a sword cut," he said.
"And a fatal one." This he did not voice, though he suspected Heinrich knew.
I thought it would hurt more," the peasant said. "But I feel cold, as if I had winter in my belly. Father, I have lain with Hildegard and Müller, and once I struck Gerlach Jaeger in anger."
Dietrich leaned in close so that the others could not hear the confession. For the most part, the man's trespasses had been stirred only by short-lived passions. There was no true wickedness in him, only the stubborn pride that had driven him to live apart. Dietrich drew the sign of the cross, using his own spittle, and offered him the words of God's forgiveness.
"Thank you, Father,"
Heinrich whispered.
"It would grieve me to have her alone in heaven. She will be with God, won't she, Father? Her sin does not condemn her."
"Her sin?" Dietrich raised his head and searched the room for Altenbach's wife, and saw that the woman weeping in the corner was Hilde Müller. Beside her, Gerda Altenbach lay with her throat slit and her clothing ripped from her, although a blanket now covered her decency.
"No,"
he told the dying man. "She committed no sin, but was sinned against, as St. Thomas taught." Altenbach relaxed.
"Poor Oliver,"
he said.
"Your sons are Jacob and Jasper, no?" "Brave lads,"
he whispered.
"Defend their mother."
Then he gave up his ghost. When his hands fell away, his guts spilled from him.
"All dead,"
said Manfred from the doorway, and Dietrich turned to him.
"The two boys are in the yard."
The hare's glance flickered toward Gerda, rested on Heinrich.
"There was a gardener who worked for him, calls himself Nemandus. He hid in the woodpile and witnessed all. Tried to flee from me, so he must be off someone's manor. Nemandus, indeed. It's little I care for sending him back.
He saw 5 men in mail, but much disheveled, so I take them to be those outlaws from Falcon Rock that Long Nose ran into.